Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Discover luxurious duvet sets today. Visit harrycurry.com for stylish comfort this spring.
I'm going to go straight to Louise now. Good afternoon, Louise.
Hi, Katie. Thanks for speaking to me today.
Delighted to talk to you, Louise. And you are talking to us from France.
Exactly. I'm here in France.
And you are a secondary school teacher.
Yeah, so I'm an Irish secondary school teacher who's been living in France just for the last year, but I was previously living in Ireland and teaching over the course of the last 8 years. I did a little stint in New Zealand as well, but predominantly I've been working and teaching in Ireland.
And where are you originally from in Ireland, Louise?
I'm from Mayo.
All right. And what do you teach?
I teach PE and biology.
Okay, and I think I read somewhere recently that biology in particular is one of those subjects that the schools are crying out for teachers in.
Well, yeah, it seems a lot of subjects, there is quite a shortage across the board, really. I don't know in particular about biology, but yeah.
And Camir, you have decided that you would like to come home and you applied for a job with the Galway Roscommon Education Training Board. So those interviews are coming up now.
Yeah, exactly. So I put in my application and I was delighted to get a response back to say that I was being called for interview. So I read that and it was to be this Friday. I thought, okay, perfect. I'll just respond and ask them to do it online. I've done this before. So when I was in New Zealand, all credit to City of Dublin ETB, that was in 2019, I applied for a job with them and there was absolutely no issues. They replied and said, perfect, here's the link. We'll meet you online at this time. Mm-hmm. So I kind of just assumed there'd be no issues this time, like, you know, quite a few years later, and things have advanced since then as well. But unfortunately, they responded to say that they don't do any interviews online and they couldn't facilitate me.
I must say I was so surprised to hear this because particularly because of the job that you're applying for, we are hearing so much about teachers being in huge demand and a lot of talk about so many of our teachers ending up in Dubai and elsewhere. Surely not facilitating online interviews is going to severely cut down your possible pool of applicants, I would have thought.
Well, certainly. It's just another barrier that teachers abroad are up against, you know. I mean, I'm in France. Maybe I could have managed a flight home if I had, you know, if I could afford it. But there's people out in Dubai that it's just absolutely not possible. And, you know, you're missing out on a huge pool of talent over there, especially.
Talk me through, how complicated would it be for you to get home for an interview on Friday? You could fly, where would you have to fly into?
Well, yeah, so for me, I'd have to get to Basel, which is in Switzerland. I'm in Strasbourg. Then I would fly to Dublin and I would then have to find a way to travel from Dublin over to Athenry where the interview was. So look, I would have been maybe able to consider it, but I'm actually moving home next Wednesday, two Wednesdays from now, on the 5th. So it just wasn't plausible with, you know, everything that's going on in my life. And, you know, I set up meetings all the time and I know how easy it is to do it. I've done interviews before online without kind of any, you know, any question. It was easily facilitated. So like you said, I was quite surprised, you know. I'm definitely just a bit disheartened.
And is it the first time you've come across this barrier?
In fairness, it is, yeah. Because as I said, like CDECB 6 years ago now, absolutely no problem. They did it. I've done another interview with, it wasn't a teaching job, but it was a civil service job, an Irish civil service job recently enough. And that was, you know, absolutely no problem to do online. And I do have another interview lined up in the coming weeks that is scheduled to be online as well. So, you know, it's 2025. Like, I really just don't think it's acceptable to be saying blanket no, that's not possible.
Yeah, well, we asked the Education Training Board, who obviously have branches all over the country. The main Ireland branch said that each branch is an independent statutory body and they have to respond individually. So we did get on to the Galway Roscommon Education Training Board. They were the people who have set up these interviews. And we asked them why they didn't facilitate interviews. They just came back to us and said, unfortunately, Galway Roscommon ETB doesn't facilitate online interviews. All our interviews are done in person. If you're unable, that's the response to you. And the response to us was, at this time, we do not conduct online interviews for any candidate invited to interview as part of the current teacher recruitment campaign. They say, however, we're constantly evaluating our processes and exploring ways to adapt to the evolving needs of candidates and the hiring landscape. Like, I would have thought that evolution had happened some time ago, honest.
Yeah, and I would need them to evolve kind of in the next 3 days, really, if that was to benefit me. But, like, I don't think it's acceptable in this day and age. We're trying to teach the children in these schools that, you know, to embrace technology and to move with the times. I taught robotics before, there's coding classes, there's technology classes. And then the very people who are organising the teachers to teach in the school can't do an online interview. I don't know.
Would this job have been one that, you know, you're moving home anyway, but would this have been a job that would have set you up basically for your return?
Well, it would have certainly, if I was successful, it would have certainly been a really nice kind of security thing to have coming home. I am still going to move home, but obviously, again, similar people to me and could be in the situation and need that job to move home. And, you know, not be able to come back to Ireland despite wanting to come back without a job secured. So if we're saying that we want to bring those teachers all around the world back to Ireland, you know, we have a massive pool of people all over the world, they should be able to do that from whatever country they're in. Like, again, the technology is there. It's really, really easy to facilitate.
I know a lot of the talk, you know, surveys of students and young teachers that have gone abroad for work. Like, what you're hearing is that they'd love to work at home, but the housing crisis in particular is a big issue in terms of being able to afford to work and live here. Was that an issue for you, Louise?
Certainly, yeah. So particularly in Dublin, of course, that's where I was working before I came to France for the previous 5 years. And it was becoming harder and harder every year with the rent prices. And obviously, you know, if I was thinking about buying, and that was almost just completely out of reach in Dublin. Coming home now, I will have to move to my home house, which, like, thankfully I have that option. But it certainly would be, you know, very different if I didn't have that option. And again, a lot of people would be in that situation. So, yeah, the housing crisis, teachers are heavily affected by that, obviously, with the salaries. And particularly when people are starting out, it's very hard. You have to wait a good number of years.
Sorry to cut across you, Louise. It just occurred to me, maybe the teaching posts in the west of Ireland are more sought after in that, because I know, just anecdotally, so many teachers moving from Dublin because they just can't keep up there. And a lot of them are going back to maybe their you know, original home counties because...
They need to, basically, to be able to survive and to live. I think that's probably an element. I don't think that GRETB would struggle as much as maybe the Dublin ETBs to fill these posts. But I do think there's still a bit of an inequity there where, like, you know, qualified teachers have to show up on that day in that place. And, you know, it's not always the cheapest to travel or to make your way to that location. So I think it would just be like a nice accommodation, and I think it would increase the quality of the teachers that they're getting, because they're opening it up to kind of a wider range of people.
Do you think maybe you'd be at a bit of a disadvantage though if most of the applicants were turning up in person and you were trying to sell yourself as a possible candidate online?
Yeah, I've thought about that, and I don't know the answer. There's a chance for sure, but I think that I should have the opportunity to try to sell myself, you know, online. And look, you know, there's things that nuances and stuff with being in person versus being online. But I just think, like, again, a lot of us are now used to working online and to speaking to each other online, that it's, I think it's leveling out. And, you know, maybe as time goes on, there'll be less difference, or maybe not. But look, it's the opportunity to at least be able to sit there and speak to the panel and to put your case across and to explain why you'd be, you know, suitable for the job will be the least that they could offer.
Yeah, no, I'd love to know what other teachers think about this and what other employers think about this, just for teaching jobs in particular, but just generally, is there a downside to the online interview, and why would you demand? Is it like a signal of how committed you are to wanting the job that you'd actually, you know, turn up in person?
Yeah.
And, you know, is there anything they feel that they can, you know, evaluate better when they have somebody actually in the room with them?
Yeah, possibly. I just think that like the only downside will be on the candidate side. Like, yeah. I think maybe I would be giving myself a slight disadvantage by being online versus the people who showed up. But I don't see personally why the people on the other side of the camera would, you know, what disadvantage they'd have, bar maybe having to open up the laptop and connect to the meeting. But
yeah. Louise, best of luck. You're coming home anyway, and you have another possibility of an interview down the line. So the very best of luck at that, in case the Galway Roscommon ETB doesn't evolve in the 3 days that you have. But thanks for that. And as I say, if anyone else out there in a similar situation, I'd love to hear from you. Okay, something completely different now. We all know, if you have a family pet, how much a part of the family that pet can be, whether it's a dog or a cat or a budgie or whatever. They can, a loss of a pet can be as devastating as, in some cases, as the loss of another member of the family. Can I bring in Sheila now? Sheila, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. Great to talk to you. I'm actually nearly crying. You're talking about the pets, because I'm thinking back to my Jack. Yeah.
So I mean, we talked about this today because a listener got in touch saying that they thought that employers should be thinking about giving their staff time off if they lose a family pet, because it is such a, you know, it's real grief, and people need some time and space to get over it. And we wonder what people think about that. But tell me about Jack first, Sheila.
So we got Jack back in 17th of January 2003. He had been abused, and we took him on. And he was a very special, he was a black and white Springer Spaniel, full of life. He wasn't the easiest of dogs, because he was very badly treated. But I have to say, I loved him all the more because of that. He's like a special needs dog to be, and I loved him, and he loved us. And he was my whole life, to be quite honest with you. So he was our whole life. And we had him in 2013. And he had been sick for the previous year. We thought he was developing epilepsy, but the vet said they thought he was too old. It turned out, actually, that he had a tumour on his brain. But for the year, previous year, from September 2012 till September 2013, he had fits all the time. So luckily enough, I was a teacher, so I was home, you know, I was home in the afternoon early, and then we used to get somebody in to look after him so that we knew he was okay. But sadly then it came to the end, and we had no choice but to get him put to sleep, which for me was absolutely heartbreaking. And that was we should have let him go on the Friday, but our vet, who was an amazing vet, she said, "Well, hang on to him for the weekend. And on the Monday, he had, at lunchtime, I could still see it downstairs, he had a massive fit. And we had to take him. Norm, my husband, came home. We brought him down, and I never forget it. So I'd been with my doctor the previous week for just a general checkup, and I was telling her, and she knew from all the years, because she was a great doctor, and I'd been with her all the time, and she knew how much I loved him. So she said to me that previous week, if you need time, she says, because we knew it was coming to the end, she says, no problem. So I rang. I remember ringing on the, Jack was, went on the Monday, rang on the Tuesday morning. I couldn't have gone to work. I could not have gone to work. And she said, there's a cert here for you when you're ready. And I went out and I collected the cert, and on it was family bereavement. And to this day, I just tell everybody about it, because it was the most beautiful thing anybody could have done, because some people might not agree with taking time off work. But unless you have any pet, whatever it be, a cat, dog, and the love that I had and people have for their pets, nobody will understand what it's like when you lose them. It's like losing a family member. And that's the way it was.
And Sheila, you're still not over it.
I have in front of me, when your researcher rang me, I have a book here. Everybody worked with how special he was to me. I was known as the woman with the dog, and I still am. I have two other dogs now. And I have cards here that I could read out to you. Sympathy cards. I have a mass bouquet. I got flowers sent to me. All the years and all the messages I got on my phone, I've written them into my book, and to this day I still have this here that only myself and my husband know about, but someday I will show other people. But it was so important to us, some of the beautiful messages. No, I have a picture of him in my hall. I remember after he died, there was a photographer, we went to get his picture blown up, and he actually took photographs of the kids in the school afterwards for communion. And he came over to me and he said, I never felt so heartbroken for you the day you came in to me to get your picture of your dog. He's in my hall. I have a light over him. And to this day, and I'll always, I have him actually here. He was cremated and he's on my mantelpiece in my bedroom in his box with his picture on top. And that's, yeah.
Going back to the original, as you say, your GP stepping in there and understanding what that was going to be like for you. How much time did you need at that time? Like what? How much time did you take?
Well, I knew he wasn't well, so I'd taken, teachers can take course days. I'd taken the course day on the Monday, and then she gave me the Tuesday, and she gave me 2 days. She gave me the Tuesday and the Wednesday, and I went back in on the Thursday. And I just functioned. I could tell you stories. I used to come home in the afternoon and play a song when I came in that I used to play when he was around. And I was literally roar crying when I used to come in from school. My sister, my family all know how upset I was over Jack. He was such a beautiful dog.
And you haven't got another Jack since? You haven't got another...
No, I tell you what happened. Jack used to go to kennels, best kennels in the, and Declan there, he's fantastic. And when Jack died, Declan rang me in the January and he said, I have a black and white dog here. Annie is her name. She's a cracker of a dog. And I said, oh, Declan, no, I couldn't really, I just couldn't do it again. He said, come up and have a look. So on actually St. Bridget's Day that year, 2014, myself and Norman went up. And I didn't take her straight away, but Norman really wanted to take her. So we took her and we have her since. And she is a cracker of a dog. And she's black and white, actually. When Norman came back with her the following week and I opened the boot of the car and I saw her, oh, my God, I said, it's always Jack again, because she's black and white exactly like him. But she's a crossbreed. She's a terrier. Mm-hmm. And then in January, I rescued another dog, and the two of them get on great. They're downstairs. I'm upstairs here because normally when I go on the phone, they bark. So I came upstairs and I was making another call.
The bond, I mean, you love these two dogs, but the bond is different to the bond you had with Jack.
Yes, because Annie is a very independent. Jack was very needy. I mean, I tell you a story. I ended up in hospital with them because we were walking up the Hose Road in Raheny here, and he saw a cat, and I went into a pillar. I was taken away by ambulance. And somebody said to Norm, my husband, afterwards, would you like him to be put to sleep? And I said, no, you must be. I actually was disgusted with the idea. I would not have parted him for anything. We used to cross the road if I saw another dog coming. People probably thought I was crazy in Raheny. I'd hide behind a car, but I would have done anything for that dog. And he would have done, and he loved us too. Now, Annie is very independent, but I love her in a different way. But no, no, the bond, I don't think, will never be the same again. Because now I have another little Chihuahua cross now, and he is, as I won't say needy, he gives you as much love. Whereas Annie would go off and sit in the garden now all day watching the cats. Whereas the Scooby I have now, he'll follow me around. So maybe that bond will come again. But now I do love Annie. Don't get me wrong, but it's just a different type of bond that I have with her.
Well, we hope Annie isn't listening, Sheila. That Annie isn't listening to Live Line now and wondering and feeling insecure.
She wouldn't care less.
Going back to what, and I know you got in touch with us after you heard me saying this to Louise,
yes.
That, you know, would some employers balk at the idea of...
I'd imagine so, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Because, I mean, I don't
and,
think,
yeah.
Yeah, that there isn't a total understanding out there, I think, yeah. Of the depth of grief that can overwhelm somebody in this situation.
No, like yesterday when you're talking to the men who had the prostate cancer and they were saying, unless you walk in their shoes, you don't understand what it's like. It's the same if you have a pet. Unless you have the pet and you love that pet, you do not understand. People think you're crazy, actually, but you do not understand the bond, the love. The walks I have, I was out this morning with them in St. Anne's, walking around. The amount of people you get to talk to, no, it's just incredible. I can never imagine myself not having a dog. The day I can't walk down the road with a dog is the day I want not to be here. And that's quite the honest truth.
Okay, Sheila, hang on there. I want to bring in Margaret. Margaret, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. How are you doing?
Great, Margaret. Now, tell me about your lovely dog, Kim.
Well, yeah, I had my dog, Kim, for 10, 11 years. And eventually, a little bit like your last caller, she succumbed to cancer. She was a golden retriever cross with a collie, as far as I remember. Maybe there was a few other types of breeds in her as well, but she was a mongrel dog, but mainly a retriever. And I was told that retrievers, by their breed, do tend to succumb in their later years to tumours. So anyway, we got Kim from another family when she was about 3 years of age. The family really didn't bother too much with her anymore. She was left in the back garden most of the time and she didn't have much interaction with the family. And in the end, anyway, my husband, he heard about this particular dog and asked me would I like to take her, because the dog was being allowed to leave the family. And I said, oh, of course, I'd love to take her. So I got a photograph of her and immediately I wanted to go. And this would have been maybe 10 o'clock at night, but I wanted to go then to get the dog. I wasn't even going to wait till the next day. However, anyway, we met up with the dog and took her on board. Now, at the beginning, when I got Kim first, she was very, very flighty and not relaxed at all. For the first 3 weeks, to be honest with you, I felt like giving her back, because it was a big problem. It was very, very hard to look after. But one day I decided, right, that's it. We are going out in the car and we are not coming back until you are sitting in the car properly in the back of Cease and not climbing out about, you know. So anyway, that was the beginning of the training. And eventually, yeah, that day she didn't come back into the front of the car with me, and on going from that, we got lots of training into her. She was a very, very intelligent dog. Everything was going great. I often had her at the vet just for checkups, just to make sure that all was well and her injections and all sorts of things. And then about a year before she died, I don't know if you've a connection with a pet, you just know when something isn't right. So on, and I eventually asked the vet, look, what is the problem with her? He told me that he thought that she had cancer. Now, I was given options to have chemotherapy for her. She would have been around 10, 11 years of age at that stage. Options for chemotherapy, various scans to check out exactly where the tumours were, and medication. And I decided, no, I'm not doing it.
You wouldn't put her through that?
I wouldn't put her through it, Katie. I wouldn't put her through that. You know, the dog had lived a long time. She'd had a great life with us. And I felt, look, whenever the time is right, I'm just going to let her go. So I asked the vet, look, what do you think? Oh, he said, no, hold on for a while, hold on for a while. She's no pain, no issues, really. It's just that she was getting to a point where she wasn't eating as much as she would normally eat. She wasn't as agile as she normally would be. And I said, look, well, when am I going to know when the time is right? And he told me categorically, you know, she'll tell you. She'll tell you when the time is right.
And she did, Katie.
Absolutely, because it got to a point where I was actually carrying her. Now, the dog would have been around 25 to 27 kilos, and I'm only 5 foot nothing in height. I'm a small little girl, you know. And I used to carry her bodily outside to go to the toilet and wait till she went to the toilet and brought her back in again. And this particular night, it was the day before I got her put to sleep. This particular night, she just, I don't know, she just looked at me. She was lying on the floor. And I said, look, do you want to go out to the toilet? She tried to get up off the floor and she couldn't. And I said to myself, this is it.
Yeah.
This is it. So the next day, I rang my vet and I said, look, she's done exactly what you told me she would do. And I said, I think the time is right. So I brought her down anyway to the vet and we did the deed and I stayed with her right through until she was gone. I mean, absolutely broken. Look, I cried her ever. Now, I may as well tell you, you know. And then in the end, I got her donated to veterinary science because I felt it would be a help to the students to be able to work on a real animal, because the vet has told me now, and I'm open to correction on this, but apparently an awful lot of veterinary colleges, they use models and like not real animals because they can't get them anymore, because most people get their pets
cremated
either buried
now.
Or
yeah.
Cremated, you know.
So
and
you...
I said, no, we're going to do it this way. I'm going to get something out of this for other animals.
Tell me,
and that's what I did.
And tell me, Marg, and that must have been just that having to make that decision is obviously very hard. And I know, and I want to be careful that I'm not equating the death of a pet with a family member.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's on another level. But going back to the starting point here, would you understand why people in those circumstances would need a day off work? And do you understand why maybe an employer might say, oh, come on now?
Well, here's the thing now. At the time, I wasn't actually working outside the home. I was in college and I was in my fourth year in college. And this sort of business was all going on behind the scenes, you know, with my dog. And in the end, following day after I had to get Kim put to sleep, I had to contact the college, the lecturers that I had that day by email to say, guys, you know what? There's no point in me coming in because I'm going to take nothing in, nothing. I'm just totally distraught. And I thought, now they're going to think I'm completely bonkers, you know, because like your last caller, she actually hit the nail on the head that nobody understands unless they've been there.
Damn.
And that's about everything, Katie. That's about everything, really.
That's about
everything. You know?
Do you know what, though,
yeah.
Margaret? I would say a lot of people do take time off because, like you said, there's no point in you trying to work or trying to take anything in.
No.
But they probably don't tell their bosses why they're taking the time.
Yes, that's true. Now, in my case, I know they'd have come down kept fairly heavy on me if I didn't turn in for my lectures that day. And as well as that, I was quite close to some of my lecturers and they really understood very clearly when I said, look, I had to get my pet of 10 years plus put down to yesterday and I just can't take anything in. And they really did. They sympathised. they did, because they would have had pets themselves.
Yeah. Well, as you say, if you've been been in those shoes, you do understand probably. But
Yeah, for sure. And I think really, you know, I mean, a day off, you know, most, for heaven's sake, everybody's human.
Yeah.
You know.
Margaret, thanks for that. And Sheila, thanks.
You're very welcome.
Thank you
very
so much. Mary. Mary,
hi,
good
Kate.
Afternoon.
Hi. Hi. I was just listening to Sheila there, and everything she said is so true. So true. I lost my Ollie 2.5 years ago, and to this day, I'm still brokenhearted over him. And people, now, I'm lucky a lot of my friends are doggy people, but the ones that aren't, it's very hard to explain to people the depth of love that you have for that animal and for the love that they had for you as well. You know, and I, like, we lost him 3 days before Christmas in 2022, and we had to put him to sleep. You know, and I know we could have kept him over Christmas, but we thought we couldn't let him suffer, and we had to do what was best for him and put him to sleep. And it was the worst Christmas ever. And yeah, and as Sheila said, she has a picture of her dog. I have a huge canvas print on the wall of my kitchen. And next to it, I have two prints of my granddaughter, but his is in the main. Oh. His is bigger than my granddaughter.
Why does your granddaughter think of that?
No, well, she's in Australia, so she's never seen them. I had the print ever before he died. I had a print made up of him. And I have in my kitchen here his ashes and his paw prints, and I have his collar around it. And yeah. Yeah.
Does anyone say to you, Mary, that you're a bit...
Katie, anybody that knows me knows the way I was, because I was very vocal about him when he was alive. And it wouldn't knock a feather out of me, anybody saying, you know, oh, you're stupid or whatever. I loved him and I put no bones about it. And he loved me. And like my husband and my daughter were here as well, but it was me that he went to. He was a rescue, and he just came into my mother died in March of 2011. My other dog died in June, and I decided I can't live without a dog, so I'll foster. So I fostered for, I presume, I don't know whether I can mention the charity or not, and within an hour of getting Ollie home, I knew that was it. I'd never give him back. There was just something about him. And there are certain dogs like that.
I was going to say, is it like, you know, when people talk about romantic situations like love at first sight, do you think there are special connections between...
Oh, 100%. No, I loved all the dogs I had when I was growing up. And I loved Fred that I had before Ollie. And we had him for 13 and a half years. But I never, ever experienced anything like the love that we had and that we got from Ollie. I mean, he had two previous homes before us, and I don't think he would have had the best of time. He actually had the big blue eyes. He was a Shih Tzu, a white Shih Tzu with big blue eyes. And we went on holidays, and he was being minded, and there was some tussle happened with another dog in the house, and he lost his eye. And we had just gone to Fuerteventura on the Saturday, and we got a phone call Saturday night. So we flew back home on the Tuesday. We tried to fly. We'd have flown anywhere to get home to him. So, yeah. And people thought we were nuts to do it. But, yeah, no. No apology to anybody for what we did.
No apology, no regrets.
No, absolutely none. None whatsoever. None whatsoever. But, yeah. I know it's very hard to explain to people that don't have... Some people have dogs and, like, they like them and they're fond of them and, you know, all that. But they don't feel the love that I had for... that we had for our dog.
Yeah. You put it very well, Mary. Thanks a mil for that.
Okay.
take care. Take care of yourself.
Thanks a million. Bye-bye.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Annette, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. I'm calling in because my beautiful, I had a lovely ginger Tom, a rescue as well, 15-year-old cat called Shamie, who became so ill. He also had cancer, and it came to the time to put him to sleep. And people may not know this, but the fetch will come to your house. You arrange it with your fetch. So I made an arrangement with the fetch, and the fetch and a lovely nurse both of them came up to the house. And Shamie was in the comfort of his own home, asleep on the armchair before the sedation was given. So he had none of the trauma, where he used to get very upset getting into the carrier to be brought down and I'd have to get a taxi. He had none of that trauma of getting into the carrier, knowing where he was going, which he really didn't like. So he just very peacefully slipped off at home on his armchair. And it was the kindest thing to do. The vet and the nurse were absolutely lovely. And for me, it was far less traumatic. Yeah.
Yeah, isn't that it?
Actually, people may not be aware of that.
Yeah, it's a good point, actually, because a lot of dogs and a lot of cats don't have good memories of going to vets. So
no.
You don't want that last journey for them to be, you know, to have trauma involved in it.
Yeah, yeah. And it was easier for me too, yeah. I had a friend there with me and, yeah, it was much easier.
Yeah, how were you afterwards, Annette?
The loss is terrible. I mean, I had the cat for 15 years and it's just the company and the kind of companionship of having an animal in the house. So there's a lot to get used to coming in. The cat's no longer there. And yeah, but I will essentially get a dog because Shamie was the boss, so he wouldn't tolerate a dog. So he's a big, very big, assertive ginger cat. But he had a great life, so, you know. Yeah, you just have to grieve an animal, you know. It's just very sad when they go, yeah.
Annette, thank you so much. And as I say, that's a good tip for somebody that maybe just at that time wouldn't think about it.
Yeah, just ask your vet, and I'm sure they were more than willing to help. They do it for people, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that. Thank you for that, Annette. Now, I'm going to switch topics because I want to talk about those fires that we had in some parts of the country, started off over the weekend. All that lovely weather, of course, led to some very, very dry ground, which, of course, is not good if there's a fire. Kate, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie.
You're down there in Goree, Kate.
I'm in Tar Hill in County Wexford, yeah.
So tell us, when did the fire actually get going there?
The fire started early Sunday afternoon and very quickly took hold and rampaged across the hill. The hill is covered this time of the year with gorse and heathers, etc. And as you know, there was no rain for the last number of weeks. So perfect conditions for even a spark to start a fire. And then the wind whipped up and drove it across the hill.
Yeah, it's quite frightening, isn't it, when a fire takes off like that?
Very, very frightening. And the upper part of the hill, it's hard to access. You know, the lanes are very narrow. Now, the Goree Fire Brigade responded very quickly and they were later joined by other units from different parts of the county and possibly Arklow, I'm not sure. But it is very frightening to see how, you know, a spark even can fly. When the wind picks up, the sparks can and the cinders can move from one part of the gorse to another. And the hill is full of gorse. But trees, not just the gorse, but the trees were also burnt. I mean, it is now, the hill is completely devastated. It's really sad to see.
Is this something that happens regularly there on the hill? Is this an unusual thing to happen?
The last bad fire was Easter 2014. And again, we had a very dry period. And the contributing factor then also was the wind, which whipped it up and drove it across the hill. But the damage and the devastation is far greater this time round. The fire, actually, there's a bit of smoke still smouldering on the hill, even up to lunchtime today. But it is under control, and for the most part, it's put out. I have to say that, I mean, the local community, the farmers in particular, worked tirelessly to support the fire brigade. You know, they were out drawing water from morning to night, late into the night. At one stage on Sunday evening, there were 15 tractors and rigs up on the upper parts of the hill, just trying to keep the rigs fed with water. The farmers were amazing, and the local community as well, everyone pulling together to try and, you know, get the fire under control.
Were there any houses actually in danger at any point?
Yeah, there were a couple of houses that had a close call. Now, one on Sunday and into the night, late Sunday night, another one. And then again, I understand yesterday morning I was up the hill early myself around 8 o'clock and there was a rig went up behind another local house. The wind was the major factor because you just didn't know what way the fire was going to turn next. But thankfully, as far as I'm aware, no houses were burnt and thank God no one was hurt. They're the main things. But I think that the availability of water is really the issue. You know, trying to get water that high up the hill, having it in significant amounts available to the rigs, and then the narrowness of the lane. And the upper part of Tower Hill is managed by Creelta. So, you know, the gates would be locked off, but the gates were opened. But it's getting the water up the hill. And without the help of the local farmers, I think we would have seen it go on for much longer.
Well, thank God, as you say, nobody was injured and no houses went under there. I think everyone has a new appreciation of what a wildfire can do after what we saw in the States, in LA, and those fires there in the early part of the year. Kate, thanks for that. I want to bring in Seamus because this wasn't the only wildfire over the weekend. Seamus, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Kate. How are you?
So you're up there in West Roscommon.
We were in West Roscommon, yeah. We were very near the Mule border, about a mile and a half from the Mule border, small village. And we had a big fire on Sunday and up to last night. Started on Sunday afternoon, around 2 o'clock. And as your previous speaker said, the winds were very strong and fanned it up. And where it started, there was local people had their turf cut there and a lot of it was saved. And they made efforts to save it, and I think most of it was saved. But what happened then, it was just the winds kept fanning it, and it crossed the road and into the forestry area. So
it actually managed to jump across a road?
Yes, yes. And it's what you call a main thoroughfare between Castlery and here. Like.
How far away from your own house would the fire have been, Seamus?
Well, it started about 2 kilometres, but it ended up about 500 metres, 600 metres across the road. It came, you know, it travelled probably 2-3 kilometres, 4 kilometres to my house and then diverted up towards the Mule border. And so it went through forestry and then into a special area of conservation. That's all destroyed. And it diverted up towards the Mule border and then the winds brought on eastwards, and that's where it was on Sunday. So on the Sunday evening, it came very near the village, and local farmers went out with their tractors and slurry tankers spraying water on the roadsides just to try and prevent it, and the fire brigade were there. And the two helicopters arrived, and they were taking water from local lakes, and only for that, it would have spread to a number of houses. Two or three families were evacuated, and they got back again yesterday into their houses. But it was very scary because the forestry comes right up to the road, the main road.
It must have been really frightening. And just from your own point of view, like, you must have been very worried about your house at that stage if it was 500 metres away.
Well, it would, but luckily enough, whatever the way the wind, it took it away from my house and brought it more towards the west and up towards the village. Those houses along there, you had this community centre and the school and 4 or 5 houses that are along that thoroughfare. And they were within the width of the road from the fire.
Again, though, to say nobody was injured.
Nobody injured, no, there was nobody injured, thank God. And you know, thanks to the, I think it was four fire brigades, had the Ballyhonest, Balladreen, Clare Morris and Boyle fire brigades. So, and then you had 2 helicopters, I think they were through Culture. And then yesterday we had an Air Corps helicopter again. So at some stages there were 3 helicopters bringing water and dropping it on the fire.
Yeah, an incredible operation, and incredible that, as you say, even though some families actually got to the point where they had to be evacuated, no houses
were damaged. One farmyard, there was some sparks into the farmyard and burned some straw in it, but that was the only damage, I think, to a property as far as I know. A lot of fencing, farmers' fencing is burned, and we have a, there's on the especially air conservation, there is a Sports Ireland walk, registered walk, and that is burned, and signage and all that on it. Like, so we haven't investigated it yet, but I'm sure there's a lot of damage up there.
Yeah, would you have seen anything like this before up there, Seamus?
Not to this extent, no. We had one about a month ago that started in the same place, and it went eastwards because the winds were coming from the west. It did some damage, but you're probably talking about 60, 70 acres on that one, but this one was hundreds of acres burned, you know. And local people had invested in forestry for their pension funds, I'm sure, and they're all destroyed.
Yeah, God, we were just talking about problems with forestry on the Upfront programme there last week, and there's enough issues going on without this visiting them as well.
Absolutely, yeah, because there is a lot of controversy over where you saw it, and, you know, it's very near properties where we are, like, and it's only coming to light now, the danger of it with fires like that, because they are mature trees here now, and they're probably 40, 50 feet high, like, so the flames were probably 60, 70 feet or more.
Yeah, God, it must have been some sight to behold.
And I suppose that was probably the problem. A lot of spectators coming and had to close the road, you know, which wasn't very fair on the firefighters, and that they were trying to do their best. You know?
Yeah, you'll always get the rubber neckers, and now of course you get the rubber neckers with the phone out.
That's a phone footage, yeah.
Seamus, thank you for that eyewitness account, and Kate, thanks for that. And as we say, the good news out of both of those is that nobody was injured.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, I want to bring in Gina. Gina, good afternoon to you. Do I have Gina on the line there?
Hi, Katie. Yeah, thanks. Lovely to speak to you.
Yeah, Gina, you're a school secretary.
That's right.
And people might remember that there was a campaign a few short years ago because we only realised that, or I only realised at that point, that school secretaries were not employed in the same way as other people in the school. School secretaries and caretakers were often laid off over the summer and were on these short-term kind of ad hoc contracts. And you very successfully campaigned for that to change. And you're now paid directly by the Department of Education, which I think is only right and proper. But there is one problem still.
Yes. Just to give you my situation as an example, and this would be replicated up and down the country for the vast majority of school secretaries and caretakers. I work in a rural school in County Tipperary. I'm one of 20 staff here. All 19 of my colleagues in the staff room, the principal, the teachers and the SNAs, will all rightly and properly receive a public service pension when they retire. I am the only one who won't. We are all employed by our Board of Management. We're all now paid by the Department of Education, as you say, following a campaign that had been going on for years by school secretaries in the past. But we're still locked out of public service pensions. We're not treated as public servants, even though the work we do is public service work. We're all in a building with all of our colleagues assisting in the delivery of education for the nation's children and young people. And we're fed up of being treated as different or somehow lesser. It's an inherent unfairness that we've been campaigning against for years.
Yeah, and as I say, there was that campaign, and as it was a successful campaign, because, and I think it surprised a lot of people when they realised that the school secretaries in many cases didn't have to go on social welfare over the summer until that was rectified.
Yes, that was the same for me. I drew unemployment benefit every summer, every Christmas, every Easter. I was paid when I was in the building, and when I wasn't in the building, I wasn't paid. So we our that campaign led to us finally being paid throughout the year by the Department of Education, and we're now on a graded pay system, you know, like a clerical officer payroll grade, which was great, and it's a step along the way, but it's a step short of public servant status, which is what we are looking for now.
So just to be clear then, you are paid by the Department of Education, but you are not considered a public servant. Is that right?
No, that's exactly right. Everybody, the teachers, SNAs and secretaries, caretakers, we're all employed by our own boards of management, but the Department of Education are the paymaster. So it's within the remit of the Department of Education, you know, to look after our affairs. But we're not deemed public servants, and that's where they're saying we're not entitled to a pension because we're not deemed public servants. But our argument is we're public servants in everything but name and everything but the terms and conditions that we get. You know, on a day-to-day basis, we are doing public service work. We're dealing, obviously, daily with the Department of Education between payroll, the free book scheme, making data returns. We deal with the revenue, with payroll, ERR returns. We deal with the Department of Social Protection on the school meals programme. We even deal with the Department of Foreign Affairs. We can assign passports for people. So everything we do every day is public service work. It's inherently unfair that we are deemed lesser in terms of dedicated work that we're doing for years and years on behalf of the public service, on behalf of the Department of Education. To be locked out of pensions is inherently unfair, and we've just had enough. We don't deserve to retire without a secure pension. We're tired of being treated as second class in our own schools, and we're ready to take action in terms of a ballot for strike action, which is going on at the moment among school secretaries and caretakers up and down the country.
We asked the department about this, and they said that, again, just what you're saying there, since September 2023, the Department of Education is providing a payroll service for secretaries. That's how they're putting it. And they're saying this was what was agreed mm-hmm. with FORSA in the conclusion of your campaign. They said that it includes the revised terms and conditions for secretaries. The agreement, which has provided for a revised salary and annual leave entitlements, because, of course, yeah, you now get some annual leave entitlements. They did not grant school secretaries with public service status. Therefore, this cohort does not have access to the single public service pension scheme. That's the pension scheme, say, that teachers would be in. And there is no pension scheme in place for school secretaries employed under the new terms and conditions of employment as outlined. So, yeah, so they're basically yeah. saying this is what was agreed, and that's where they leave it. They do say that for secretaries who are paid through this payroll scheme, a facility is now being offered to join a PRSA scheme administered by Corn Market, with contributions being deducted at source. Is that an option,
yes.
Gina?
Well, I mean, it's an option that they're putting out there. I mean, we're not accepting of it. It's very much, this is the auto-enrollment scheme that the government are introducing for, you know, all manner of employees who don't, their employer doesn't provide a pension for. But again, our position is the inherent unfairness versus what everybody else who we work with in the public service gets. A PRSA scheme is very much an inferior product compared to the public service single pension scheme, which is a defined benefit scheme. It's guaranteed by the state, and it's based on your earnings over the lifetime of being in the public service. That's what public servants get. Whereas a PRSA scheme is a savings scheme where you pay in something, your employer pays in, the government will top something up. It's being invested on your behalf. It's not guaranteed. You're building up a pot of money that you don't know how much it's going to be. You may be able to buy yourself, you know, some sort of a pension when you retire. So if nobody I worked with had any sort of a pension at all, then that's a start and it's a step along the way. But again, we're back to the inherent unfairness of what everybody else in the building doing the same work up and down the country education is receiving, and we're being locked out and treated as lesser or different.
Gina, will you hang on? I've got Jean on the other line. Jean, good afternoon.
Sure. Good afternoon, Katie.
You work as a secretary in Leitrim.
I do. I actually work part-time in two primary schools in County Leitrim. So I just feel very personal that, you know, we're all equal in when it comes to terms of the school. The secretary is an internal part of the school system. We do so much behind the scenes that people don't even realise. And yet we're being treated differently. The teachers, the SNAs, they're getting their pension. And yet the secretaries and caretakers have yet to achieve that status.
Yeah, you kind of feel that this is a very personal issue. You say you feel a bit of an outcast.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love my job as secretary. There is so much enjoyment seeing the work that I do being carried out throughout the school and how that affects the children's education and how the teachers, how I go out of my way to help the teachers and SNAs wherever I can. And I just feel like if we're being paid by the department, we should have equal status, the same as the teachers and SNAs.
I think, as you say there, a lot of people might not realise what secretaries actually have to do. But I think a lot of parents would appreciate secretaries because you have a lot of interaction with secretaries a lot of the time. And they are the sort of the link person between the students, the teachers, the management. You know, they can really form the kind of, you know, be important in the culture of a school.
Absolutely. Lots of times where like I said, we're the first port of contact with the parent. The parent phones the school if they need to inform the teacher about something about their child, or if we need to contact the parents, you know, we send lots of emails and text the parents, and we make it as personal as we can and approachable as we can. And we definitely try to enhance the school system by being approachable and being as helpful wherever we can be. And I just feel at the moment, we've gotten so far with Forset, they are absolutely amazing. And if we can just get this one step closer and get the pensions that we need, it would be the icing on the cake. It would just make the job even that much better.
I'm thinking as well, the changes we've had in the last few years with the school book schemes, that must be an awful lot of extra work for school secretaries.
It is. I mean, obviously, they don't have to do the book scheme. I think it is voluntary. I know I have personally opted to do the book scheme in both the schools that I work in. So it is a lot of extra work. But again, I try to make it as easy for the teachers as possible. So when they come back in September, the books are ready to go. The names on the books, all they have to do is hand them out to the kids. And I try and make it as easy as possible, again, for the teachers so that it's easier for the students and makes it much easier than to start the new school year going forward.
Can I put you, Jean, that what you're looking for, which is to be part of the pension scheme that the other people in the school, the teachers in the school, are part of, that is a high ask, isn't it? Because there is not that many people now who would aspire to a direct benefit pension. You know, most people who are getting, you know, paying into pensions now would be part of direct contribution pensions, which would be not as valuable to them, basically, as the direct benefit schemes.
Yeah, no, we just look to be part of the public service status, to be equal to the other members of staff within the school setting. And I feel that's only fair that we do have that same status, because we're, like Gina mentioned, we're all employed by our board of management. We're now being paid by the Department of Education. We're technically all under the same umbrella. So I don't see why we can't get the public service status and to get the pension equally as the teachers and SNAs. I think it's only fair.
Well, Gina, can I put that to you? Is this your...
Sure.
Is this a negotiating position for you, or is it this pension or nothing?
No, I mean, it's very much, it's a pension parity campaign. We're looking for parity with, as we said, all of our other colleagues, all doing public service work in the same building for the same Department of Education. You know, there are also situations where, depending on the contract or the type of school that you work in, some secretaries, a minority, but some secretaries would have a pension. You know, if I worked in an ETB school as a secretary, I would have a pension. There are some community and comprehensive schools where you would have a situation where some secretaries are employed under a clerical grade and they would have a pension, and others are employed under the same system as me and would have no pension. So, I mean, if that's not unfair, where two people can sit at the same desk and do the same job and not have access to a pension scheme, you know, we're not asking for something that other people doing the same work in a public service environment isn't already getting. As I said, if nobody had anything and this PRSA was something that was being offered, then that's a start. But it's the inherent unjustness and the difference and the being treated as second class is what we're just not accepting anymore.
Okay, Gina, we will watch this space. I'm sure this isn't the last we've heard of this one. So thanks for that, Gina, and thanks, Jean.